Hello, and welcome back to the Neurology Exam Prep Podcast. My name is Harry Sutherland, and while you may recognize me from the recent episode on infectious myelitis, radiculitis, neuritis, and myositis, this is my first time hosting. Today, we will be discussing disorders of speech and language with a focus on aphasia, but also covering praxis, as well as the prosody, articulation, and phonation of the spoken word. To help us understand these topics, we're grateful to be joined virtually by Dr. R.G. Hillis, who can offer a very unique perspective as a former speech-language pathologist and current professor of neurology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where she serves as the Deputy Director of Neurology and the Director of the Cerebrovascular Division. Dr. Hillis is an expert on linguistic disorders with a special focus on post-stroke outcomes and recovery, as well as primary progressive aphasia. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Hillis.
It's my pleasure, Harry.
So perhaps before we begin our discussion of the disorders of speech and language, we should first review the relevant anatomy that we'll be encountering. So Dr. Hillis, would you mind walking us through the main perisylvian language areas of the dominant hemisphere?
Sure. So the primary areas are Broca's area, which is more or less in posterior inferior frontal gyrus, and it includes three parts, the pars opercularis, the pars orbicularis, and the pars triangularis. And then the Wernicke's area is the other really important area, and that's an area primarily in the posterior superior temporal gyrus. And it's very important for word comprehension, recognizing speech sounds, and discriminating speech sounds. The angular gyrus is another area that's always activated during language, and it has some kind of integrative role in language. So it integrates information from a variety of inputs, so visual and auditory input. And we know it's very important for reading. It's also probably important for word finding. And then another area that's always activated is in dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. Part of that area is Brodmann's area 6, which is sometimes known as Exner's area. It's very important for writing, but it is activated during other language tasks. So it may have an important role in planning language output or organizing language input. And then there's a white matter tract that joins Broca's and Wernicke's area called the arcuate fasciculus. It is important in terms of connecting different parts of the language network, especially Broca's and Wernicke's area, but we know it has different parts that also connect Broca's area to angular gyrus to Wernicke's area, and so on.
All right. Thank you so much for this helpful overview. Maybe to help us with some neighborhood anatomy, I think it might be helpful to point out to some of our listeners, Broca's area is very near the mouth motor cortex, probably not a coincidence, and Wernicke's area is also very near primary auditory cortex, also probably not a coincidence. We, of course, now realize there's much more to the picture than the classical representation of these perisylvian areas. So what other brain regions seem to play a role in language functions?
So there are a number. Almost every functional imaging task, for example, will show activation in the homologous regions in the right hemisphere. And so we'll talk more about what those homologous right hemisphere regions are doing. And part of it has to do with understanding and producing the tone of voice or prosody. Other areas include the cerebellum, which is important for, as you know, timing. And timing is important for a number of aspects of communication. And it may have some other roles in language. It certainly has connections with all of the language areas. The basal ganglia have a little bit unclear role in language. They have more of a role in speech production. So they're mostly motor areas, but they also provide activation to some extent to the cortex and may be important for sort of gating language, helping people formulate a thought and then getting it out, for example. The thalamus is often considered the gateway to the cortex. It has a number of different nuclei that are involved in language and other cognitive functions. And it is, again, provides activation of different parts of the cortex. And then angular gyrus, which is part of the inferior parietal cortex, But the other part of the inferior parietal cortex is supramarginal gyrus. And it is very important for phonological working memory. So it is involved in kind of holding the sequence of words while you try to understand them or produce them in a sentence. Disorders that are associated with damage to the supramarginal gyrus, for example, impair sentence repetition. So they understand this sentence pretty well, but they may completely reword it when they try to repeat it because they can't hold it in phonological working memory. It's also important for things like holding a telephone number in your mind while you try to dial it. And then the inferior temporal region, especially a part of the brain that is inferior and posterior to Wernicke's area, sometimes called fusiform gyrus or the inferior temporal region, Brodmann's area 37, is very important in naming and word retrieval, but also in reading and spelling.
All right. Thank you so much for this very helpful review of all of our cortical as well as subcortical anatomy. So to briefly recap the main areas we've discussed for our listener, four quote-unquote main areas of the Broca's area, Wernicke's area, the angular gyrus, and Exner's writing area, all these connected by the arcuate vesiculus, and then these other language areas in the diffuse network that includes homologous non-dominant parasylvian regions, the cerebellum, the basal ganglia, the thalamus, and then the supramarginal gyrus, another part of inferior parietal lobe, and the inferior temporal regions. So moving into disordered language, when assessing a patient with a suspected language deficit, how do you go about examining them?
Well, first of all, we just listen to them talking to see if their speech is effortful or has misarticulations or has speech sound areas called paraphasias, which are, well, there's different types of paraphasias. Semantic paraphasias are substitutions of semantically similar words, such as saying dog in place of cat. And then phonological paraphasias are phonologically similar word substitutions or non-words, so saying tat for cat or jat for cat. And then there's also neologisms, which don't sound anything like a word. We also listen to see if they're grammatical and if they have sort of fluent, melodious speech versus very difficult, effortful speech. And then we have to assess comprehension, both word comprehension and sentence comprehension. And we often do that at bedside by asking them to point to various things in the room. We can also ask questions, very simple questions like, does a person usually have three eyes? Is a horse larger than a dog? Does Monday come before Tuesday? We ask them to repeat sentences, and we can do both short, familiar sentences, like it's a rainy day in Baltimore, or we can do long, complex sentences, like I only know that John is the one to help today. Then we ask them to name objects. It's important to ask them to name things that they see, like you can hold up a cup or a fork, and some less familiar things like a watch band or an earring. And then also having them name things to definition. So we want to make sure that they recognize the object. So you might have them feel a cup or a fork and name it from tactile exploration or describe it to them. So you say, what do you drink coffee from? What color is grass? It's best to have ask them to name a lot of different parts of speech. So not just objects, but also actions. So you can say, what do we cut paper with? What do we spread butter with? And then colors, like I said, what color is snow or what color is grass and so on. One thing that is often neglected is reading. So you can ask them to read words, read sentences. There is a particular type of reading disorder that's very localizing, alexia without agraphia, and they can't read words, but sometimes they try to read each letter separately. So they look at the word chair and they might say C, and then I don't know if that's an H or an N, But if you spell it out loud to them, which you should do at bedside, if you say C-H-A-I-R, they'll say chair. So it's not really a problem with recognizing the spelling of the word, but they can't get from the word to meaning. And then ask them to write. Ask them to write simple things like their name, which is the most preserved, or a sentence that you dictate to them. And then you also want to look for things like apraxia of speech. And this is a problem with speech articulation, motor planning, and programming of speech articulation. So you ask them to repeat polysyllabic words. And I often ask them to do it three times, because the classic feature of apraxia of speech is that they say it differently every time they say it. So it's sometimes called numerous and varied off-target attempts. So if you ask them to say the word escalator, they might say escalator. Oh, you know, go up and down. So they can say each of the sounds, but they can't land the appropriate order of articulation. They're not dysarthric, which we can talk about later. And then there are some associated signs we look for, often functions that are in regions nearby the speech and language region. So we look for facial weakness, for example. For people who have damage to Broca's area, they'll often have right facial weakness and right arm weakness. In people who have lesions in the temporal lobe, they often have a superior visual field cut on the opposite side. So those are important things to look for. And in everybody, you know, we want to do a complete neurologic exam. Some of these patients, especially with larger right-sided lesions, may also have right neglect and hemispatial neglect and things like that.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning these other associated signs, reminding us that language is not an isolated brain phenomenon that we can dissociate from other findings in our patients. I guess I may also want to mention that since you brought up alexia without agraphia, and we brought up naming different components of objects by confrontation for our patients, they may also sometimes have a visual verbal agnosia that sometimes can look like anomia. So sometimes I'll be on rounds and I will be convinced that a person is anomic, but really it's just that they can't get the information from their visual area to their language area to express what they're seeing, but they could, by finding the word, use it properly.
Right.
So thanks again for the overview of how to examine these patients. Before diving into each type of aphasia, what would you say are the main types of aphasia syndrome seen in clinical practice for us to keep in mind?
So for example, the classic aphasia syndromes include Broca's aphasia, which is really a type of aphasia that occurs with damage to the superior division of the middle cerebral artery. So that includes Broca's area and inferior frontal gyrus, but may also include parts of parietal cortex, for example, in the insula. And this type of aphasia is characterized by really effortful, struggling speech, trouble with speech articulation. They usually have apraxia of speech. They also have agrammatic speech. So instead of saying it's a rainy day in Baltimore, they might say rain, you know, today, Baltimore. So they leave out the little grammatical words or functors. And in addition, they do have, it's much more subtle, but they often have some problems with comprehension, particularly of syntactically complex sentences. So for example, they have trouble understanding passive sentences. They may understand the boy was chased by the girl as the boy chased the girl. Then there's Wernicke's aphasia, and it is caused by a lesion in the inferior division of the left middle cerebral artery. And Wernicke's aphasia is characterized by poor word comprehension and jargon speech. So their speech is very fluent, it sounds melodious, there's no effort involved, but So it makes no sense very often, or very little sense. They may every once in a while say a sentence that makes sense, but most of the time they're speaking in jargon. And it can either be what we call extended English jargon, like, this is the thing I did before that I wanted the, you know, the boo-boo that I was never even before that. And it was hysterically funny, but I was the one that, you know what I mean? It was boo-boo down there. Or they can have neologistic jargon. So it's more of a mission. They sound like they're talking, but they're not actually producing any words. Or there could be a mixture of both. The other classic aphasia syndromes are conduction aphasia, which is classically a problem with sentence repetition. And again, they may hear a sentence, they understand it. When they try to repeat it, they kind of paraphrase it. They get the meaning across, but they can't produce the exact sequence of words. They often also produce some phonemic paraphasias, which they self-correct. Sometimes this is characterized by getting closer and closer to the word. So if they're trying to say scissors, they might say scissors, and finally self-correct. Global aphasia is really difficulty with both comprehension and production of words. So they typically don't say anything, or even more common, they say a single word or a single phrase, like good night, good night, good night, or tan, tan, tan. And transcortical aphasia, which is anytime you think of the word transcortical, think of intact repetition. So it's the opposite of conduction. So there's transcortical motor aphasia, and it sounds just like Broca's aphasia, except that they have disproportionately intact sentence repetition. And transcortical sensory aphasia sounds like Wernicke's area, but their sentence repetition is actually intact. And there's also a mixed transcortical aphasia. It doesn't occur as often with stroke as it does with dementia. And that's characterized by poor comprehension, poor production. They have very little speech output, but sentence repetition is intact. So these people are really echolalic. So if you say, hi, Mrs. Smith, they'll say, hi, Mrs. Smith, and so on. And then there's anomic aphasia, which is just a pure impairment of naming or word finding. Typically, both written and spoken naming are impaired, but you can have modality-specific anomia, where people can say the word, but they can't write it, or they can write the word, but they can't say it.
All right, thank you. So to recap, our main types of aphasia are Broca's, which is characterized by lack of fluency and agrammatism, tends to be in the superior MCA division. Wernicke's, which is characterized by paraphasias, neologisms, jargon, tends to be inferior MCA. These transcortical syndromes have relative preservation of repetition and tend to be in the border zones of ACA-MCA in the case of motor versus PCA-MCA in the case of sensory. Anomic aphasia, they will have pauses, circumlocutions, substitutions, maybe they may perseverate acutely, can localize to inferior temporal lobe, and more chronically is less specific in terms of localization. And then the last classic aphasia syndrome was that conduction aphasia, which could be the arcuofasciculus or supramarginal. And then we talked about that as a possible disconnection syndrome. Some other disconnection syndromes we should mention for completeness when discussing disorders of language are those of pure word deafness and pure word blindness, aka alexia without agraphia. Dr. Hillis, would you mind describing the clinical presentation of these syndromes and what brain areas a responsible lesion disconnects?
Sure. The most common is the one I mentioned already, which is pure alexia. It's also called alexia without agraphia. Sometimes in the chronic stage, it's called letter-by-letter reading. It is very localizing. It almost always occurs with lesion in the left occipital lobe. And so all the visual information is processed in the right occipital lobe. But they also have a lesion in the splenium of the corpus callosum. And these two lesions often occur with PCA infarcts. And the damage to the splenium prevents visual information from the right hemisphere to cross over to the left hemisphere for processing. So they can see a word and they can even sometimes trace it, which may help them recognize it. But that visual information, if they don't trace it, can't get over to the left hemisphere language area to say what the word is. Again, if you spell the word out loud to them, you say C-H-A-I-R, they'll say chair. They also can write words, so that's why it's called alexia without agraphia. It's really a disconnection between vision and language. And very often, acutely, these patients often also have what's called optic aphasia. And optic aphasia is the same disconnection, really. It's right homonymous hemianopsia from a left occipital lesion with a lesion in the splenium of the corpus callosum. So they look at a picture and they recognize the picture. It's not a true anomia, but the information about the picture can't really get to the left hemisphere to name it. And so they may sort of describe parts of the picture. They may have a little bit of recognition that they can convey, like if they see a picture of a cup, they might gesture drinking. And that might be because they're connecting to sort of right hemisphere semantics, but that they can't say it out loud. And very often, if you give them the same object, they can name it if they can feel it. So for example, with cup, you give them the cup, they can feel it. And that doesn't require visual processing, and the tactile information can be processed in the left hemisphere and can access the name. So they say cup. Also, if you say, what do you drink coffee from? They will say a cup or a mug. So they can name to definition. And typically, if you don't have any visual stimuli, they don't sound aphasic at all. They have pretty normal conversation, both in terms of comprehension and production.
Gotcha. So in addition to having difficulty with reading, they can have difficulty with a number of other tasks, like naming a color they're confronted with or an object they're confronted with.
Right.
I hear it's also possible to get this syndrome without a field cut. How common is that to see?
It's not.
It would have to be a very small white matter lesion, I imagine. And then the other disconnection syndrome would be that of pure word deafness. So what brain areas does that disconnect?
So pure word deafness is typically damage to both auditory cortexes. So spoken words, they can't understand, but they can understand written words. That's why it's called pure word deafness. I'm not really convinced it's a disconnection syndrome, but it's certainly a syndrome that is a modality-specific one, but it requires bilateral lesions in auditory cortex.
Thank you for this rich discussion of cortical and subcortical aphasias. I do also remember that, you know, when I was in medical school, we learned about these cortical areas, but when I was an early PGY2, I was surprised to see a patient who I felt had a pretty convincing transcortical sensory aphasia, but the lesion wound up actually being a stroke of the thalamus. Would you mind walking us through the aphasias that may be seen with pathology of the deep gray matter, including the thalamus and basal ganglia?
So thalamic aphasia is pretty common. As I mentioned, it is important in language processing and is important for stimulating areas of cortex. And so there's a loss of visual and auditory information to language cortex when there's a thalamic lesion, and it can cause what we call diaschisis, that is dysfunction of a remote area of cortex caused by damage to another area. And so that's thalamic aphasia. Typically, it is either just an anomic aphasia, so they have impaired naming, or a transcortical sensory aphasia, where they can repeat pretty well, but they have impaired comprehension and low content in their speech. In terms of stratocapsular aphasia, it is very controversial. I think acutely it exists, but it's not due to damage to the basal ganglia or internal capsule. It's due to hypoperfusion of the cortical regions. So if you have a basal ganglia lesion, for example, with normal perfusion, you don't have a frank aphasia. If you have an MCA plaque that cuts off the striatocapsular vessels and causes a deep basal ganglia lesion, that same plaque is also causing cortical hypoperfusion. And so we've demonstrated this with perfusion imaging that patients, other than thalamic strokes, subcortical infarcts acutely, only cause aphasia if there's also cortical hypoperfusion.
All right, thank you. Very complicated circuitry we're dealing with here for sure. We've mentioned vascular distributions, and most of the examples we brought up have been strokes. So we'll say that most commonly strokes, but also any other focal lesion can cause the various aphasias we've discussed. The aura of a migraine may also have negative linguistic phenomena as mefocal seizures. There is the interesting pediatric epilepsy syndrome of Landau-Kleffner, where patients develop progressive aphasia. And aphasias are also quite common in the dementias, including Alzheimer's and frontotemporal dementia. Frontotemporal lobar degeneration encompasses a heterogeneous group of primary progressive aphasias, which have different clinical features, different localizations, and even different pathologic proteins. So Dr. Hillis, since this is an area of expertise for you, would you be able to briefly review for us the different types of primary progressive aphasias?
Sure. So the first is non-fluent, agrammatic primary progressive aphasia. And this is characterized by effortful speech, apraxia of speech, and agrammatism. So they produce kind of telegraphic speech. So they sound just like a patient with Broca's aphasia. The difference is they get worse over time. So they have impaired processing of complex grammatical sentences. It is generally caused by a tauopathy. The second type of or variant of primary progressive aphasia is semantic variant primary progressive aphasia. And this used to be called semantic dementia. And while the non-fluent variant mostly is associated with atrophy in Broca's area and the insula, areas that cause Broca's aphasia with stroke, in semantic variant primary progressive aphasia, almost always the areas involved include the inferior temporal cortex and anterior temporal lobe, more on the left than on the right, although the right is involved as well. When the right is involved more than the left, we get a different syndrome that's characterized by impaired prosody and face recognition. But when it affects the left hemisphere, we get semantic variant primary progressive aphasia, which is in many ways is like Wernicke's aphasia in that they have impaired word comprehension. Their speech is usually jargon. It's usually not the neologistic jargon, but more the extended English jargon. So they have fluent, meaningless speech. But also because the right hemisphere is involved some too, when you have bilateral anterior temporal atrophy, there can be objective nausea as well. So not only can they not name an object, they often don't even know what it is or what it's for. So they might do inappropriate things like take a corkscrew and try to eat peas with it or butter bread with it. It's caused by frontotemporal lobar degeneration caused by TDB43. It is sometimes associated with a genetic mutation that also causes behavioral variant frontotemporal dementia and also causes ALS. Then the last type is logopenic variant primary progressive aphasia. And logopenic literally means too few words. So logo meaning word and penic meaning not enough. And so logopenic primary progressive aphasia is really best thought of as an atypical type of Alzheimer's disease. So it's almost always caused by Alzheimer's pathology, but more in the left temporal and parietal cortex than in hippocampus and mesial temporal lobe, like we would see in typical Alzheimer's disease.
All right. Thank you for this very rich and wonderful discussion of the primary progressive aphasias and what these patients may sound like. And to briefly recap for our listeners, there are three types. There's the non-fluent agrammatic type, tends to mean more inferior frontal, associated with tauopathy. The semantic variant, which tends to be more anterior and inferior temporal, which is more of a TDP43-opathy. And then the logopenic, which is even more posterior and tends to be more associated with an Alzheimer's type of dementia.
Right. Yep.
So transitioning from pathologies, which may cause syndromes of language dysfunction generally, let's now consider some that affect speech specifically without involving language as a whole. So with that, I tend to think of apemia as an apraxia of speech production. Dr. Hellis, would you say this is a fair characterization?
Yeah, so most people would say apemia and apraxia of speech are the same thing. Gershwin didn't like to talk about apraxia of speech. He thought apraxias should be limited to disconnection syndromes. And apraxia of speech is not a disconnection syndrome. So he preferred to call it apemia. And Norman Gershwin is the person who sort of brought back these classical aphasia vascular syndromes from the 1800s.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for disentangling apraxia of speech versus apemia for us. Our speech can convey so much more information than words alone. So Dr. Hillis, how would you describe prosody and how do you assess for it at the bedside?
So there's different types of prosody. One is linguistic prosody. So prosody is just changes in the tone of voice, the pitch, the loudness, the rhythm, duration of words and stress that convey either meaning in linguistic prosody or convey emotions in emotional prosody. Now, linguistic prosody might be something like differentiating a statement from a question, like you were here versus you were here. That's more of a left hemisphere language mediated type of prosody. But emotional prosody, like I didn't know you would come versus I didn't know you would come, give different meanings, but more emotional meanings. So in the first one, the person might sound angry or upset. And the second one, the person sounds more happy and surprised. The emotional prosody is really mediated by more right hemisphere networks and often the right hemisphere homologs of language cortex. So damage to the right inferior frontal gyrus, for example, can cause difficulty with expressing emotion through prosody. So the person sounds very much like this, oh, I had a wonderful time. And it can be very distressful because people think they're depressed or sarcastic and don't really understand their true meaning. Receptive prosody problems can occur with damage to more ventral areas like the temporal cortex, where people don't understand the prosody of others. So when somebody says, oh, that's a beautiful dress, they might take them seriously. Or if they said, oh, won't you come? They'll understand it as more like, oh, won't you come? So they really misunderstand when their caregivers or family are happy or sad. And it can result in a real breakdown in communication.
Yeah, understandably. And that could worsen caregiver burden, which we all know is already such a hard thing to deal with after stroke, especially. But it does sound like these brain areas really are pretty good homologs for one another between dominant and non-dominant hemispheres. For our speech to be comprehensible to others, not only do we have to use correct lexical and semantic elements, meaning our words have the correct meanings, and we have to appropriately link them with the proper syntax or grammar, but we have to sufficiently articulate and phonate our speech for the listener to make sense of it. So beginning again with anatomy, Dr. Hillis, what's the difference between articulation and phonation? And what are the relevant head and neck structures involved in each?
Sure. So articulation is really movements of the lips, tongue, jaw, palate that produce speech sounds. And phonation is the voice. So it's based on really vocal cord function. So a dysphonic person will sound like this or will sound like this. Whereas an impairment of articulation, they might have normal phonation, but they're very slurred. So it's the difference between producing speech sounds versus voice. And then there's even something called resonation, which has to do with how nasal or hyper or hyponasal the person sounds. So, you know, when you have a cold, you sound kind of hyponasal because your nose is all stuffed up. So you can't get air through your nose. And that can be due to not a problem with the nose, but can also be due to a problem with the palate, the soft palate. So if the soft palate can't go up, you often have hypernasal speech. Or if it's spastically up, you have hyponasal speech.
Thank you. Interesting. So with this anatomy in mind, what exam techniques do you use when evaluating a patient with dysarthria? And how does this help you think about their condition?
So first of all, you listen to them when you're taking the history. So any kind of connected speech is important. Sometimes it's necessary to have them read out loud when you know the words to know what they're trying to articulate so you can figure out sort of what's going wrong. Many people learn to ask them to say pa-pa-pa, la-la-la, ka-ka-ka. That doesn't help much at all. Instead, you should say, I want you to say as quickly and evenly as you can for as long as you can, pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa-pa. And ta 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 and ka 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 ka. If you just do it three times, you won't be able to pick up some of the problems because what you're listening for is rate of speech. Are they saying ta ta ta? Rhythm of speech. Are they saying ta 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 ta? Or even range of motion of the speech articulators or precision of speech. So they might sound weak or have reduced range of motion. They can't get the tongue all the way up to say ta. They say ta, 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 ta. And then we also assess phonation. So I ask them to say and hold it as steadily as they can for as long as they can. And healthy people can usually hold it at least 20 seconds. If they can only do a few seconds, they're having problems controlling their vocal cords, either opening or closing them, controlling the escape of air at the level of the glottis.
Very helpful. I certainly have been very guilty of just having someone repeat a phrase like pa-pa, ta-ta, ga-ga just twice and thinking that's sufficient for dysarthria. So thanks for pointing out the limitations of this. And perhaps to try to form an association, it sounds almost like your exam for dysarthria kind of mirrors the exam we do for coordination or cerebellar testing. We're looking for meter, we're looking for rhythm, we're looking for precision. But of course, certain cerebellar disorders can cause dysarthria. So turning into that, what are the major types of dysarthria and what kind of speech do they produce? I know there's a whole list of particular types of dysarthria. Sure. Do you use them? Do you find them helpful or do you have your own thought process?
Yeah. So, you know, it's like any other cranial nerve dysfunction. And it's a good way to even think about differences between upper motor neuron, lower motor neuron dysfunction, cerebellar dysfunction, extrapyramidal dysfunction, and so on. So, one type is called spastic dysarthria or pseudobulbar dysarthria, and it's caused by damage to upper motor neurons bilaterally. And it sounds spastic, basically. It sounds, so they have just like other spastic movements, the range of motion is decreased, the tone is increased. They're not necessarily weak. It's mostly a problem with range of motion and speed of motion and tone. And so if you ask them to say pa 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 pa, they'll say bah, 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 bah. It's very slow. It sounds spastic at the level of the vocal cords, so they're not getting good range of motion of the vocal cords. And it's not very precise because they have reduced range of motion. So even more with ta ta ta, they might say bah, 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 bah. And you also hear some hypernasality because the soft palate is spastic as well and has reduced range of motion. So it doesn't close off the nasal escape of air. The second type is called bulbar or flaccid dysarthria. And that's caused by lower motor neuron dysfunction or at the level of the neuromuscular junction. So in both cases, the primary problem is weakness. And the tone is okay. Range of motion may even be increased. Somebody with flaccid dysarthria, for example, might come in holding up their jaw because they don't have the strength to keep their jaw up. And they may be able to talk intelligibly only if they hold their own jaw. Otherwise, when you ask them not to hold their jaw and you ask them to say pa 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 pa, they'll say they can't get their jaw to even get their lips together. They sound weak. So Again, the phonation will be kind of breathy. They won't get good pressure between lips and tongue and so on. Their rate of speech is okay. And that's not the main problem. It's mostly weakness. So in somebody, for example, with myasthenia gravis, they may come in and you ask them to count to 100. They'll say, you can hear them only being able to say a few syllables at a time on one breath, because so much air is going through their nose and escaping at the level of the glottis. But if you give them Tensilon, say about the time they count to 10, they might say, oh my God, I can talk. So you'll see this gradual improvement in strength of the speech articulators and the vocal cords. And then this extrapyramidal dysarthria is also usually, there's two types. Hypokinetic is the rigid type. And that's like in Parkinsonism. So just like other movements in Parkinsonism, the range of motion is very decreased. And the rate of motion may actually be, in a sense, increased just because range of motion is decreased. So when you ask them to say pa 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 as quickly and evenly as they can, they'll say so they have these short rushes of speech. Their speech is called hallelalic, but it's very similar to their gait, right, which is festinating, these teeny tiny steps. So they'll say, they're barely moving their lips and tongue and jaw. So that's hypokinetic. Hyperkinetic is usually caused by basal ganglia lesions, and they move too much. And likewise, their speech will be too loud, uncontrolled, lots of extraneous movements. So if they want to say pa 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 pa, they might say pa 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 pa. And their mouth goes way open, too wide. They stick their tongue out too much, and they're too loud, and so on. And cerebellar ataxia sounds like people who are drunk. And that's no surprise, because alcohol affects the cerebellum acutely. So they just don't get the timing right. So if you ask them to say pa 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 pa, they'll say pa 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 pa. They're very arrhythmic, but their spontaneous speech is often slow because they're trying to compensate for their timing problems. So they slow way down. Just like drunk drivers slow way down in their driving, people will slow way down in their speech, and it's called scanning speech. So they will often talk like this. And not just drink. Because you drink, I am officer. So they're kind of slow. They can't control their pitch very well. So their pitch goes up and down kind of involuntarily. So those are the main types. Motor neuron disease like ALS causes a mixed dysarthria with bulbar and pseudobulbar features. Although often the pseudobulbar features are the most noticeable. So they first present with kind of slow speech, slow, reduced range of motion, but then eventually it becomes weaker as well. So they'll say, so they're both weak and reduced range of motion and increased tone. They will often have fasciculations of the tongue, which is the main lower motor neuron sign early on.
Thank you for all these wonderful illustrations. You're helping train not only our minds, but also our ears. So thank you for being willing to demonstrate all these different types of dysarthria. This has been really helpful for me. And thank you also for specifically stating what scanning speech is, because I used to think that scanning speech was kind of like a Xerox machine, just going very monotonously over the text that you're trying to read or what you're trying to say, rather than actually being the scanning, like you're scanning poetry, looking for dactyls and spondees. So again, thank you for training our ears here. So those major types of dysarthria we covered again are the motor neuron or flaccid type, the spastic type, with respect to the extrapyramidal systems. We talked about hypokinetic versus hyperkinetic, as well as cerebellar ataxic. Turning to dysphonia, what characteristic voice changes might we hear with bilateral versus unilateral vocal cord weakness?
So with unilateral vocal cord weakness, it sounds usually just either breathy or harsh, and it's not terribly severe. So when you ask them to say, ah, the sound, whereas bilateral lower motor neuron weakness is sometimes they're totally aphonic if they're paralyzed in an open position. So they'll say, they sound like a whisper. Or if they're closed, they'll, if they can say anything, it'll sound very tight and they'll barely be able to get any air through.
Yeah, and they may also have an inspiratory stridor as well as when they try to exhale and verbalize.
Yes.
Thank you. So movement disorders too can also impact phonation, whether tremor, as with essential tremor, or dystonia, as with spasmodic dysphonia. Would you be able to comment on these clinical entities?
Well, the essential tremor is often just a tremor of the vocal cords, and it can often co-occur with a tremor of the head. So you'll be able to hear some tremor in the voice like this. And it is not terribly severe. There have been some very famous actresses with this kind of dysphonia. Spasmodic dysphonia is a little more abnormal sounding. So they have intermittent spasms. Their vocal cords just a spasm closed, and they can have inspiratory stridor, but they can also sound like they're trying to force out their speech. And it can often be treated with Botox, whereas the essential tremor of the voice isn't usually treated because it's not terribly disabling.
Gotcha. Thank you.
It was Audrey, if you ever saw Audrey Hepburn on Golden Pond, she had an essential tremor of her voice. She just sounded kind of old.
Huh. I'll have to cue it up. So we've certainly covered a lot of ground this episode. Just to summarize our discussion, we covered the cortical, subcortical, and deep brain structures responsible for speech and language. We've gone over how to examine patients with disorders of speech and language. We have reviewed the major aphasia syndromes by their patterns of language deficits, as well as the subtypes of primary progressive aphasia. We have mentioned the disconnection syndromes of pure word deafness and pure word blindness. We have distinguished aphemia from aphasia. We have talked about prosody as a non-dominant hemispheric process for enriching our speech. We have classified the various dysarthrias, and finally, we have heard how weakness and movement disorders may affect phonation. Thank you so much, Dr. Hillis, for sharing your time and your expertise and acting abilities with us today. It's been a real pleasure on the program.
My pleasure. We covered a lot of ground, Harry. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Thank you as well to our listeners for tuning in to learning about disorders of speech and language. My name is Harry, and I've been your host. Now signing off for the Neurology Exam Prep Podcast.